Once the conviction is entered, he killed him.
If there has been new evidence that the ballistics information may have been tampered
with, there is no such evidence, sir.
There is evidence.
No, Tlaib. I don't want to scream, and I don't want you to scream. And it's Friday, and we're you know, a couple of minutes from all of us beginning to think about dinner and the rest of it. I don't want to scream at you, man. But I have to tell you. You want to do some research, you can do some simple research, you can go online, and do yourself a favor, stay away from some of the nonsense put out there by the Free Mumia Coalition, all these other idiots. What you need to do is go online, look up the records from the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia, the Superior Court, and the Supreme Court in the state of Pennsylvania, and you can read the transcripts yourself, and at that point, Tlaib, please, feel free to call back, and I'll be happy to have a dialogue with you. I appreciate the call to talk 910 KNEW. I don't want to be angry about it, but it does make me angry. Because I know exactly where Danny Faulkner got killed. I've been there. I've been there many, many times. I know cops who were working.
Shut the hell up, Jeff Camps. It's nonsense about I don't want to scream at you. Yeah, you don't. You just want to lie and deceive everyone who gets within your particular warpath. Then you babble out. There is no evidence of the evidence being tampered with. Yeah, tell that to Cynthia White. You know, this is why this comes down to power, and these clowns will have to be served with power. From the .44 caliber bullet turning from a .38 caliber, to Judge Sable saying, I'll help you fry the nigga. And from the true murderer admitting that he did it on tape. From the ballot or the bullet to the judicial system or the bullet. It's become clearer and clearer every day. And then you say, you stop using the word alleged once you're convicted. Yeah, right. Tell that to a convicted killer. Geronimo Pratt, until we proved you fools had helped set him up. Well, it's time to let all the slaves free. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. Listening to 104.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz in Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, The World, RadioForAll.net, The Universe, Slave Revolt Time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into what's happening with the society, that many types of things that should help awaken people's humanity and consciousness seems to slide right off, as we'll deal with how things in this society and its own humanity are slipping into the abyss. From the JTF-6 Marines to what's happening in Fallujah. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
We believe that in addition to the very important pieces of legislation dealing with amnesty, dealing with the Central American situation, those of us at the border intend to press upon the Congress to reevaluate a border policy that is resulting in the deaths of hundreds along the border and record number of deaths. And so for us, we will not be satisfied alone with the issue of amnesty and dealing, of course, with the problems that immigrants face once they're in the country. But we are going to very deliberately and very openly really begin to question in a big way the public policy that is militarizing this border as we speak. Yesterday, day before yesterday, they brought in 20 soldiers as part of Joint Task Force 6 to continue with their, quote, reinforcement of the border. If people could see photographs of what that means, they would think we are at war with Mexico. And so for us, that is a human rights crisis that we are facing and that we will continue to face, because this new fence, this wall, this steel matted wall, is being extended another 2 miles in Douglas. For us and for the immigrants, that means that they have absolutely no way to receive any kind of human assistance, no way to be near an urban or a town, urbanized area or a town, and in fact they've got to trek out 4 or 5 miles into the desert, into the mountains, where they face their death, and sometimes they face hostile ranchers and other folks. And so for us, that's going to be a key issue that we intend to bring to Congress. We have recently been apprised that there is a proposition, a resolution in the town of Wilcox. I mean, yes, we've got small communities, small towns that have economic, they're economically repressed, and so they feel that when there's federal dollars dangling, and this is a very difficult situation for us, when they dangle huge federal dollars, of course, the community, the politicians, of course, in particular, are very eager to attempt to have those built in those communities, but we are also very concerned with the growth, of course, of the prison industry as a whole. As a criminal defense attorney, I am very alarmed at the growing rate of the prisons across the country. But in particular, in regards to this issue, we're very concerned about these joint operations between Bureau of Prisons and these private corporations and INS that are coming together to build more and more prisons to house more and more Mexicanos in particular. This is an alarming situation for us. We are criminalizing whole sectors of our community. Anybody who's undocumented and is caught and is charged with illegal entry, just illegal reentry, false papers, transporting an undocumented person that can be your companions or your family members, and on and on. We have a whole slate of criminal immigration violations that are just flooding the federal district courts and system along the border. And of course, responding to that, a burgeoning caseload of new criminals, we need new prisons. That's what they believe, that we need new prisons. And so we believe it's an alarming situation, and we hope to address those issues as well at our summit this coming weekend.
Well, we oppose amnesty because it's more than simply forgiving of somebody who has broken our laws. It's actually forgiving them and then giving them a reward. And the reward is that they get to stay in the country that they didn't respect enough to come here legally in the first place. But before we go any further than that, I want to go back to Douglas on the border for a minute and sort of respond to some things Ms. Garcia has said. First of all, it's not immigrants who are dying, it's illegal aliens, and it's important that we make the distinction between those who come to our country legally and those who sneak into our country illegally, and that's who we're trying to stop at the border. The National Guard is on the border, not in an attempt to militarize the border, but simply to build this fence, to continue to build this fence so that the illegal aliens won't be able to sneak across the border in Douglas, in Naco, and continue to do that. Now, it is a problem in Douglas, which is in Cochise County, because this year it's expected that 3 million illegal aliens will sneak across the border in Cochise County. And the drug trafficking is so bad that almost the entire state of Arizona is now a high-intensity drug trafficking area. And it's so bad that the sheriff of Cochise County has sent a letter to the governor of Arizona, Jane Holt, asking her to send a National Guard to the border to help the Border Patrol protect the border from this invasion. Also, the Cochise County Board of Supervisors has also sent a letter to Jane Holt saying, please send the National Guard down to assist the Border Patrol to stop these illegal aliens from crossing the border. So it's important to understand the situation on the border. These people are not immigrants. They are illegal aliens. With them come drug traffickers and criminals that add to our problem. The reason we have to build more prisons is 30% of our prison population nationwide is foreign-born. So what we need to do is to look to take care of this country and defend the border, which is what any reasonable country in the world would do. And that's the reason why you're seeing these calls for help along the border.
The disguise of a worn-out and deceitful policy called the War on Drugs. Hooligans in the U.S. government have seen fit to enlist the assistance of the Marines in Sam's ever-escalating war on the human rights, conditions, sovereignty, and constitution of the population in and around America's borders. A policy of control and terror that is so transparent in its efforts that only the most vile-hearted persons would try to defend and maintain it. Especially when in typical American capitalist fashion. It's the poorest and most isolated by this system that are the most affected by it, creating a condition where not even an 18-year-old goat herder is safe. On May 20th, 1996, in a small West Texas town of Redford, 18-year-old goat herder Ezequiel Hernandez did what he normally did at around that time after arriving home from school. Take out the family goats to be herded. But unbeknownst to Ezequiel, his family, or the residents of Redford, the Marines had landed. Under the false pretense of guarding America's borders from drug smuggling operations, the Marines JTF-6, Joint Task Force 6, four-member unit stalked out Ezequiel, the souvenir-collecting goat herder, for 20 minutes. The Marines dressed up in complete G.I. Joe attire with blackened-in faces following their rules of engagement procedures never let it be known to Ezequiel or the other residents the presence of them. The Marines started their surveillance approximately 700 yards away with M16s in hand. The only line of defense that Ezequiel had at his disposal was an 80-year-old 22 caliber rifle that was handed down from his grandfather to his father to him. The rifle's main use in this remote community of around 90 persons was to protect the goat herd from predators like wild dogs and the occasional target practicing of tin cans and other objects of the like Ezequiel would engage in. Yet little did Ezequiel know that he would become a target by these JTF-6 Marines under the guise of their anti-drug surveillance missions. At approximately 6:27 p.m., Marine Corporal Clemente Bunez shot Ezequiel on the right side of his body from around 250 feet away in what the Marines claimed was a shot in self-defense, after they stated that Ezequiel pointed his rifle and prepared to fire at them a third time. Yet, none of the nearby residents said they heard any other shots except the shots fired by the JTF-6 Marine. There's no evidence that Ezekiel even knew that these camouflaged G.I. Joes were even out there following him. It's not the mission of the JTF-6 Marines to arrest, fire warning shots, or give medical assistance to whomever or whatever victims the U.S. Marines decide to play their war games on. But even though the JTF-6 unit had a trained emergency medic with them, they not only intentionally ignored giving Ezekiel medical assistance for the initial 22 minutes he lay bleeding to death on the ground, but only at 6:49 p.m. did the unit finally even call an emergency helicopter stationed 20 miles away at Pasito Airport that responds to medical emergencies involving Marines. This was around 2 minutes after the Border Patrol agents arrived and called for an ambulance themselves at the scene. The Marines first lied straight off to an agent telling them Ezekiel hit his head. Clearly a deceitful ploy, because according to head investigator Sergeant Duncan, the Marines had reported after they fired their shot, man down, quote unquote. The Texas Rangers, who are the lead agency preparing a report for District Attorney Albert Valdez, have found themselves in a cat and mouse game with the Marines. For as Sergeant Duncan stated, the military had told the Texas Rangers that the JTF unit involved in the killing will remain in Texas for 7 days, in which time the Texas investigators hope to bring the team back to do a video reenactment. Yet 4 days after the shooting, the unit was sent running back to Camp Pendleton in California. The only rhetoric the military can hide under for shooting and allowing the innocent 18-year-old goat herder to bleed to death was that, quote, this was in strict compliance, states Marine Colonel Thomas Kelly, deputy commander of the military's anti-drug task force, with the rules of engagement, unquote. In other words, the Marines don't have the power to arrest you, but they are given the power to kill you, which was basically all that was in store for Ezekiel. But no words were exchanged between Ezekiel and the Marines. There's no procedure or training for the Marines to make contact with civilians other than deadly contact. For under the rules of engagement, the Marines are to hide and avoid detection, and if perceived, detected, and threatened, they are to kill in so-called self-defense. Yet the JTF-6 Marines had Ezekiel, the U.S. citizen, in their sights for 20 minutes, more than enough time to contact the Border Patrol agents if they felt any illegal actions were taking place, especially since they cannot make arrests. But obviously they didn't. Even if Ezekiel had seen them, which there's no verifiable evidence that he did, how was he to know who they were? Since the Marines had been camped out there 3 days undercover on a 2-week mission, at which time after the mission, they were supposed to leave without a trace to the residents of the community. So how is Ezekiel, even if he had seen the unit, to have known who they were? Since the Marines were camouflaged, how was he to have known that they were Marines in camouflage as opposed to Nazis in camouflage or Klansmen in camouflage, which is fairly common nowadays as these Klansmen often camouflage themselves in three-piece suits? They would have, they could have easily have been some 187 let's protect our borders with patriotic violent citizens in camouflage gear, but nevertheless, the most protected element by the state from this list, the military's own version, doesn't exactly jive, quote-unquote, says Captain Barry Clover, a Texas Ranger with the autopsy and other physical evidence, quote, our perception from what occurred is not consistent with the military's version, unquote. Even the Ranger's preliminary evidence shows that Ezekiel's rifle was pointed away from the Marine. Plus, the Marine's bullet piercing of his right side at the rib cage of the right-hander doesn't fit the Marine's story. Also, unfortunately for the defenders of the police and military bombings and shootings of civilians, there were no drugs found in Ezekiel's system. So the JTF-6 spokesperson who said that, quote, we serve as the eyes and ears of the Border Patrol, unquote, overlooked the question and justification of the U.S. military's involvement in the domestic affairs. Following the Civil War, the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 was passed, barring military involvement in domestic affairs. Starting in 1982, the legal protections of the Posse Comitatus Act began to find itself attacked by, of all groupings, the Ronald Reagan administration and the compliant federal courts. This erosion took place in the so-called effort to fight contraband, the fact that Ronald the Crip Reagan and his band of Contras were mountains deep with certain U.S. agencies in contraband themselves is another story. Yet the Defense Authorization Act of 1982 allowed the military to provide intelligence, equipment, and facilities to civilian law enforcement agencies and training. The militarization of the police was about to grow rapidly, and the Marines were about to land. In 1986, two legendary thugs by the name of then Vice President George Bush I and Attorney General Edwin Meese, who headed the National Narcotics Border Interdiction System, pushed through Operation Alliance, another so-called drug interdiction measure. It also included intercepting immigrants along the southwest border. This joint operation included the activities of at least 15 federal, state, and local agencies, including the National Guard, Department of Defense, U.S. Marshals Service, the Secret Service, Coast Guard, INS, DEA, FBI, and Internal Revenue. Yet Bush and his cohorts weren't through. In 1989, now President George Bush, after waving his bags of crack on national TV in a well-scripted performance, passed the Defensive Authorization Act of 1989, giving the authority to the Pentagon to integrate more centralized power. And as the 1991 Act came rolling into Congress, they authorized the military to now establish anti-drug bases, training facilities, and power to carry out aerial and ground anti-drug reconnaissance missions near and outside the borders of the U.S. The Marines were landing. But at the backbone of the Pentagon's anti-drug crusade leads us back to the Marines' JTF-6 setup in November of 1989 at Fort Bragg's Army Air Force Field. From 1990 to 1993, the JTF-6 conducted 1,260 anti-drug support missions. Yet by the first 6 months of 1995 alone, the approved number of JTF-6 support requests has soared up to 4,000 missions. On any given day, there are approximately 4,600 soldiers working their counter-drug operations on America's soil. Today, the Marines have landed. While many of these soldiers and National Guardsmen are on temporary assignment, others are on permanent drug war duty missions, with 50 Special Force soldiers providing training year-round to civilian police forces of these Special Force units. Approximately one-third of them are accounted for in JTF-6 anti-drug missions. Missions of death and destruction of our lives and freedom, as we are finding ourselves engulfed in a sea of militarized, synchronized police agencies that roam freely from rural town to urban cities, making it now even more clear that under the phony pretense of a war on drugs, this cloven-footed ex-president, crime Bill Clinton, and his Pentagon's Angels of Death partners moved closer and closer to materializing a perpetual state of emergency and corporate police control, as these militarized SWAT-like teams, entities, take the physical lead in goose-stepping into our own backyard.
The military is the lead agency under law responsible for interdiction of drugs coming in the border, and since 1989 they've been allowed to operate domestically, setting up bases, putting in roads, working with civilian officials, working domestically to help enforce civilian laws. And now what we see is across the country, the military, in particular the National Guard, is working on a wide range of drug enforcement activities, not just along the border, although that's the most militarized as far as active duty military goes. We've seen the National Guard working virtually every state in particular involving marijuana enforcement. I think it's important for the public to think of the Hernandez case as really the tip of the iceberg of a very significant change in the way we are doing our policing in the United States. There's been a lot of talk in recent years about community policing and police becoming part of the community, but really the radical change that has occurred in the last 15 years has been a militarized police force, where we see SWAT teams, for example, which didn't exist 20 years ago, now throughout the United States. Almost every drug search warrant, for example, in Fairfax County, a suburban county in Virginia, upper middle class county, is served by the SWAT team. In Fresno, California, the SWAT team actually patrols downtown Fresno. Military camouflage troops, groups of them, walking through the city streets. We've had the military work in 21 cities now in training programs with civilian police, getting out there and dropping out of helicopters in the middle of the night without warning the civilian population, dropping out of helicopters and doing urban guerrilla warfare training.
So as the Pentagon is spending $800 million a year on drug trafficking laws alone, which range from listening posts, ground surveillance radar, to advanced military operation on urban terrain, this has led George Solster, the JTF-6 Task Force Commander, Lieutenant General, to proudly say, quote, Joint Task Force 6 relationship with law enforcement, in my view, is one of total integration, unquote. A total integration of curtailing our human working class rights, as law enforcement agencies like the Border Patrol have acquired computerized fingerprinting equipment known as IDENT, that's used by many agencies that have silly symbolic names with religious and football undertones, like Operation Hold the Line in El Paso and Operation Gatekeeper out of San Diego. All of these high-tech research centers with photo ID systems are developed by the multinational Hughes Aircraft Company. This technology conveniently came out of the CIA and Department of Defense, which should come as no surprise, because under the guise of a war on drugs, war on immigration, war on terrorism pretense, which has created the excuse of a massive data information surveillance system with their worldwide intelligence gathering networks like the El Paso Intelligence Center, which has an incredible array of political, financial, and criminal intelligence on both foreign, national, and U.S. citizens, which all cuts to the core reality of what these criminals are up to, a networking for capitalists to programize, terrorize, while they criminalize large portions of the American population, to create a docile and confused, depoliticized populace, which in their interest, they hope to have large portions of the population looking at some foreigner protected by the United Nations crash landing on U.S. borders in black helicopters or planes into U.S. buildings, ready to invade while the Marines already have, which has created a society where not even an 18-year-old goat herder from Texas is safe. So with these types of contradictions of the capitalist system overflowing at the seams, the eroding and vulnerability of the U.S. dollar, depletion of the world energy and living force systems like oil and water, and the evolution of the corporate war state by administrators for the ruling class like the Boy George administration, who have been handed the deadly baton of empire and are pushing through the next phase of wretched anti-human rights, like eye retina scanning and licensing surveillance systems, all under the imperialist mist of death, whose administrators are patriotically in the act of subduing the world into a privatized one-way ticket to hell. With these types of contradictions and more being celebrated by large portions of a droned-out, gumpified, white-is-destiny society, in the not-too-distant future, if there is not a serious revolt on this industrialized, animal-farmed-out plantation, the beast may be landing on America's shores next. This has been Tracy James with a commentary. The Marines have landed in America. Out.
Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is now. Beyond the shadow. You know, as I kicked off in my commentary, the Marines had landed in America. There's something seriously wrong within the psyche of the American population. When you see things, or basically humanity, slipping deeper and deeper into the abyss, you know, many people of certain persuasions have been awakened somewhat by the Iraqi war and the atrocities and events that have happened. Yet, what Sam has been doing in Iraq is really not out of the fold of what he has been doing in Africa, Latin America, or within these own borders. In other words, on Sam's own personal plantation. But since we often have one, people who are often hypnotized within their own hocus-pocus tradition, and now that it's happening to their little, you know, tribe, they're, you know, somewhat shook up. And another element of society that has traditionally looked the other way when the masses of third world natives and others have been shocked and awed by the brunt of Sam's barbarity. You have a very dangerous situation taking place at hand. We're going to explore that a little bit on Slave tonight and start off with what's going on is a situation where humanity within America's borders is sinking deeper and deeper into the abyss. As journalist Dar Jamil, who has a website, jardemiliraq.com, that often has fairly good journalism and a lot of photos that can give you an eye view of what's taking place, can help start off this Beyond the Shadow segment of what's going on currently in the regions of Fallujah within Iraq. So check this out.
Very, very bloody and chaotic weekend here amidst the backdrop of a horrendous gas crisis, the worst I've ever seen here over the last year. We have lots of the pumps now 7, 8, 9 miles long. Basically, Baghdad is running on generators. This is also driving the cost of everything. Very just basic roof and basic food stuff because of the transportation with the rising fuel costs. It's become almost impossible to find gasoline even on the black market. So as it's winter here and people rely on kerosene and gasoline to heat their homes, even generators are now running out of fuel. It's a very, very desperate situation here now. Well, I wrote it in response to the new photos that have been released of Navy SEALs basically taking trophy pictures with prisoners who'd been beaten and possibly tortured, and they were referred to as trophy pictures. And this is very similar to reports I've had from refugees I continue to interview who've come from outside of Fallujah, who have stated that U.S. soldiers have taken the dead bodies of fighters, tied their hands behind their backs, and lashed them to the tanks, and were driving around the cities with the city of Fallujah with them during ongoing military operations, displaying the dead bodies of the fighters as trophies, and used obviously as some sort of sick psychological warfare against the resistance who are there continuing to fight them.
Now, you know, as this and other stories have come out, it's basically been this tossed over the shoulders of many people on Sam's plantation. Now, this is not uncommon in this form of demonic behavior by the fighters for the U.S. Empire is not all that uncommon. You know, as I've mentioned before on Slave, you know, they were what were called picture lynch postcards of black people. This was after many traditional American values citizens would lynch a black person off the claim, because often they didn't even go to their fake trial. So why even fake a trial? You know, they knew it was all a farce in the first place, so they didn't even often go to the pretense. But after they would lynch and burn up, and, you know, gouge out the eyes, cut off the genitals, slice off the ears, you know, if it was a mother and she was pregnant, gouge out the baby, squash the baby's head on the ground, traditional American values, stuff like that. Often after they would burn up the corpse and things of that nature, they would often take a picture of the burnt up, charred up, slashed up corpse and turn it into postcards. Postcards that would then be sent to relatives, you know, around Christmas and the holidays, and be celebrated as something that was just, you know, all part of the way of life, along with breaking up the body parts and putting them in the jars and selling them to, you know, fans of the lynching, you know, within the particular community. So the fact that you have all these particular types of things going on in Iraq is not a shock for those of us to see that there is actually a legacy of this type of stuff. But when these types of traditions are no longer not seen as being problematic for the empire, as certain historical times in America's history when slavery was not quote-unquote controversial, or when lynching was not controversial to a large number of masses, you then see a deep slip into some of the most vile forms and demonic forms of behavior of that population. And with the vulnerability of today's society, meaning the capitalist world system and the society we live in, this helps set up a very dangerous precedent.
Indeed. In fact, I just on the postcard point, I have a book Without Sanctuary that features those cards. You know, it's something that I've thought about. It's something that I have thought about, and that is, not only, look, if they sent them, they sent them to the post office, right? So if the federal government wanted to stop lynching, they could have investigated these cards, where they're coming from, who's manufacturing, what's going on here. They didn't even care.
They often were a part of it.
That's right. Now, as you notice from Tracy's earlier clip, where you have the guy, the speaking on the radio openly about killing immigrants that don't have documentation. That's another harbinger. That's a sign also. I'm going to get to Fallujah in a minute, but that is a sign of something. Because to tell you the truth, originally in the 80s, it was the Ku Klux Klan that was going around talking about manning, you know, setting up a border guard and killing illegal, so-called illegal aliens. Now, people say it as if it makes sense, and no one challenges it. Bush wins the election. Yes, we do have a problem, my fellow Americans, my brothers and sisters. This country has significantly moved to the right. We're going to have to fight. We're going to have a serious fight on our hands. But you know what? It's one thing I can say. It sure is becoming clearer. Because just one thing about these illegal aliens and how racist all that crap is against Mexicans. You know, in the earlier part of the American century, literally, thousands upon thousands of people from Italy, Southern Europe, and Ireland came to America, you know? And in fact, a racist term used against Italians during this period and after, all the way to when I grew up, was WOPs. They used to call Italians WOPs. Now, you know what WOP meant? Without papers, you see? But even there, with all of that, with their government organized, you know, attack on immigrants, and they were deporting people out of the country during the Palmer raids and all of that, generally you didn't have citizens at the just shooting and murdering in cold blood potential immigrants. This has gotten worse. Now, let's look at this Fallujah thing very quickly. What is Fallujah? What do you call it when you level a whole town? I have been, you know, we had a show on Fallujah, a program where we keyed in on that. And I since have looked at some of the pictures just of the lay of the land. It's devastating, brothers and sisters, that anybody could have even survived. You know, the people that were hiding from the military trying to survive. And unfortunately, drinking that water, which has been mixed with sewage, so that now their people are getting sick with typhus and other horrible diseases. Fallujah, to make it really plain, I want to be clear here, a war crime. There's no other way you can talk about Fallujah. And in today's world, where you can see the results of it, we need some outrage. I'm looking for outrage, y'all. I'm looking for some organizing on that matter. Because it's a crime against humanity, which means it's a crime against you. Finally, this dead bodies on tanks thing, I guess they thought it was cute, but there are some historical roots to that. It has been said that Genghis Khan, when you went to see Genghis Khan and his barbarian herds, he kept a big mound of human skulls right in front of his tent. So before you went to see the man, you'd have to see that mound of skulls before you go in there and negotiate or talk or whatever you want to do. You see? This is barbarism, brothers and sisters. Unabashed. Unabashed. It is barbarism. Abu Ghraib. Fallujah. Tying dead bodies to tanks and driving them around Fallujah in order to terrorize the insurgents. You're only going to anger them, actually. But this is barbarism. And this is why Frederick Engels, one of the co-founders of scientific socialism, warned us more than 100 years ago about the decadence and sickness of the international ruling class. And he said, you know what? Here's the choices you're going to have. Socialism or barbarism.
Now, to go into another element of U.S. barbarism, this time within its own borders, here's Catherine Campbell. She's from Prison Focus. She goes over the Corcoran rape case. This is when Eddie Dillard, who was a victim of being raped, at the behest of four guards from Corcoran who went on trial, who ordered Wayne Robinson, a legendary and known rapist. So if you got mad or pissed off one of the guards, they would send this, you know, Wayne Robinson guy to rape you. They put you in a cell with them, and if you weren't able to defend yourself to the level of getting him off you, well, you get raped. And when the trial went on to see, you know, basically if there was going to be any form of quote-unquote justice for Dillard, well, nah, there wasn't. Now, this helped, in other words, the four guards got off. She talks about that, and then she goes into a little bit of what else the guards were involved in, which was called the turkey shoot. So let's see what's going on Sam's plantation from the role of and actions of barbarism. Check this out.
No one was surprised. All of us who had been watching the trial on a regular basis could see the prosecution case slowly unravel as the days went by. So jury verdict was anticipated. The defendant's position was that they did not know that Wayne Robertson was a sexual predator, something that is impossible to believe if you're aware of the culture of the security housing unit at Corcoran, that no officers were willing to come forward and testify that as to Wayne Robertson's reputation. It's going to have overall a negative effect. It's going to embolden the prison guards union. It's going to strengthen the defense attorneys in that case. It's going to give credence to those who say that these prosecutions are part of a witch hunt. Officers are charged with civil rights violations resulting in death. There were four officers who gathered together in a control booth above the yard, which is approximately the size of a handball court. They are accused of knowing in advance that a fight was going to occur and having arranged that fight between Latino and black inmates, sending those inmates to the yard, watching them fight, and then shooting one of them, pressing tape, and killing him with a shot to the head.
So once again, you have a situation where these brutes get off for setting up the rape. Now, you wonder how stuff like Fallujah can happen. You wonder how the Abner Louima situation can happen. You wonder how the John Bird situation can happen, you know, where Bird was, you know, putting electrodes to people's genitals and ears, things like that, in Chicago. And all you have to do is understand the true barbarity of the U.S. Populace and the system that helps breed and helps validate those who basically are justifiers of this particular order. So there's a clear lineage, and unless the fronts are taken from all levels, not just watching these pathetic liberals get upset when the actual bombs start taking place in Iraq. The bombs were taking place in another way, the sanctions, years before, that were having also the same type of decimating impact. The bombs were falling on the school systems. The bombs have been falling within the whole war on drugs, war on immigration system. In other words, these guys who are behind the curtain and pulling the lever
of control and destruction of our particular humanity are working full time, nonstop, at all various levels. And unless you can see that a person in prison has just as much basic human rights as a person in Iraq or the western or southern part of the Sudan, then you're basically falling in the abyss with a large number of gumpified Americans.
You know, these guards getting off was not shocking for me. But, you know, it is a blatant injustice. Because bad enough they got your ass locked up, tell you the truth. And you got to go through all of this madness and to find out. By the way, I don't have my figure with me right now. But back a few years ago, they published in the paper there was something like 240,000 rapes recorded in the American prisons in 1 year. That now, wow, I wish I had that, you know, I had that to get. That is an enormous number. One has to wonder. But it is, if you know, there's a film, sometimes movie review is good. There's a film called where the brother's in there. And the white boy is in there, and he is a banker, and then the brother was locked up, and they started jumping on, you know, and mistreating his white boy, and they raped him, you know, and they showed how the warden of the prison knew all about this stuff, was well aware of this stuff, because at one point he threatened to use rape against the white boy, knowing that he had already had that misfortune. Shawshank Redemption, it's called. Yeah.
Well, it's a way of dividing the pop, you know, have them preying on one another.
That's right.
So you have a conquering,
the only possibility of solidarity.
Right. A conquered and divide a populace, seething with anger, you know. So you have people who are in this kind of predatory mood. And mold and stuff, and it helps benefit those who are part of the controlling order to basically manipulate the scene and have people thinking of everything except their own emancipation out of the system. It becomes just like a predatory dog-eat-dog type of thing, which they want not only within the prison system, but without it.
That's right. And that's what they want on their minds.
Right. But next off, here again is Dar Jamil. As he talks about the control center in Iraq that Sam is setting up. So let's see what Jamal has to say, and then let's take it from there. Check this out.
We are. It's very creepy news and almost unbelievable, but I guess not quite unbelievable here in Iraq these days. They've also mentioned that they're going to try to establish work brigades of Fallujah men to, while they're wearing these identifying arm badges that they're going to get, that they will be set into work brigades, is what the military is calling them, in order to go about clearing rubble and taking part in reconstruction of their own city. They feel that this is what is going to have to be done in order to keep resistance fighters from out of the city while putting Fallujahans to work in rebuilding their own city. One of the reasons they're having to do this is because while the military has been attempting to establish some sort of reconstruction in Fallujah, they can't keep Iraqi contractors there because most are too afraid. They're receiving daily death threats from resistance who are still operating very heavily in the area. So anytime people even sign a contract to complete work or to begin work in Fallujah, most days they're simply not even showing up. So this is another reason, aside from ongoing, sometimes fierce fighting in Fallujah, that there basically is no reconstruction occurring there at all.
So basically what you have is an empire that lays siege to a country. The people are fighting back with all of their particular might. And as things have gone, has spun more and more out of the control of the U.S. grip, they have become more and more draconian in their particular actions, more dehumanizing to the populace. Meanwhile, much of the population in America who is caught up within this kind of mythological image of the U.S. empire, this whole nationalistic support our flag, support our troops, support the empire at all costs mentality are basically droning out consciously while the empire is putting in more and more draconian-like measures. Work brigades. I mean, this is kind of like Nazi-type stuff. You know, work brigades and all of this type of stuff. You're on someone else's land, and now you're going to help. You're going to set up work brigades where people within a particular region, you tell them what type of work they do to rebuild back up, quote-unquote, their area that you have just got through demolishing. Meanwhile, you're continuing to wage war on their brothers and sisters throughout the whole region. This is some sick and serious stuff. But it doesn't even register to many of the drones within this society. And this is what I mean by more and more of American humanity, quote unquote, slipping deeper and deeper into the abyss.
Yeah, apparently flattening an entire city that was inhabited by 300,000 people is not enough for Sam. But here, if y'all don't get nothing else from Slave Revolt, when you hear my voice, hear this. And no, we're not just sniveling about imperialism and talking about how bad it is. We're trying to issue out a warning, Ken. Let me tell y'all something, and I want you to think about this clearly. Those work brigades they just started, one of the things they're going to use on those work brigades, which are, by the way, coerced, is an eye scan on every Iraqi in the work brigade. So that way, supposedly, they're supposed to be able to keep the insurgents out of the work brigade. They think what they want. Now, really, what do you really think is going on? You think they're really that interested, or that an eye scan of these Iraqis will really prove definitively that, you know, who is an insurgent or not? Obviously not. It's hogwash. It's gratuitous. But you know what it does show? That's what they getting ready to do to your ass. I'm trying to tell you something. They've been wanting a national ID for years here in America. The more right-wing elements of this government have been pushing for it. Then they came up with the new technology, this eye scan, supposed to work real good. They like to show it to you on the futuristic movies and James Bond and all that kind of stuff. You know, wow, ooh, ain't that cool, ain't that nifty? Yeah, buddy. Open your eyes.
And actually, now they're talking about this kind of eye scanning and licensing, one centralized licensing department and stuff like that for airports. And, you know, I saw some fat right wingers the other day on C-SPAN or some show yapping about it, you know, with this kind of fake authority type thing. And as long as you legitimize the system in any way, you help legitimize what they promote, like all the policies that they throw down internationally that often boomerang back nationally. Now, next, to get into more of the abyss, here's the human rights lawyer, Jules Labelle. He's from the Center of Constitutional Rights. He talks about the Kevin Seitz filming of a Marine shooting an unarmed Iraqi in a mosque. So let's see what Jules LaBelle has to say about this particular event. And we'll take it from there. Check it out.
The problem with the U.S. government here in the war crimes area is that they're focusing on the individual. You know, there was another incident which was recorded also by a United Kingdom video crew on Channel 4 in Britain, in which another soldier was doing apparently the same thing. And if you look at Seitz's website, what he does is he shows that he puts up quotes from different Marines, and it says the Marines say they were operating under rules of engagement, which said this was a weapons-free zone. And what they meant by weapons-free was that they could shoot at anything. They didn't have to determine whether it was hostile. Anything that they saw was deemed to be hostile in Fallujah. And it reminds you of the free fire zones in Vietnam. Under the Geneva Conventions, commanders have a responsibility to ensure that civilians are not indiscriminately harmed and that prisoners aren't executed. The real problem here is coming from the top, not from the individual soldiers. And I think the investigation should really be on what the rules of engagement were that these Marines were operating under and whether they were given instructions not to kill prisoners, to discriminate between insurgents and civilians. And my hunch is that they weren't. Unarmed fighter who is wounded is considered to be out of combat and therefore treated as if they were a civilian. And therefore, to kill a combatant who's wounded and is unarmed and is not taking part in the fight is identical to killing a civilian, and both of them are protected under the Geneva Convention.
So once again, you have a situation where the barbarity and the justification of empire by the rulers and those of it who defend the empire is always going to go on unabated. In other words, you can never look for them and your particular legislators in the Democrat or Republican Party to really challenge the expansionist mechanisms of empire, especially at its core. So the same way that you heard them twist around words like rules of engagement helps justify this weapon-free zone. So if anyone in a particular area, even a civilian area that you come across, that means you can shoot at. Now, just oppose this rules of engagement, mowing down civilians, justification and unarmed, you know, wounded people with what happened to Ezequiel Hernandez in my commentary, the Marines have landed. You basically see under the pretext of the rules of engagement, once again, the JTF-6 Marines were able to justify their gunning down of this 18-year-old goat herder, even though there's no evidence that he even saw them and was aware that they were out there. So they come in under the guise of fighting a particular, in this case, drugs. Over there is, you know, so-called weapons of mass destruction or, you know, whatever claim they're pulling out of their hat next, or cowboy boots next. But whatever the case, it's all Orwellian doublespeak to justify their expansionist goals and slaughter of masses of people who get within their way and deserve to be under their particular cowboy boots.
Yes, sirree. You know what? I think about this Kevin Seitz character.
Well, Seitz was the one who filmed it.
Oh, he filmed it. The guy that the Marine that shot
right. The
unarmed soldier.
And they've been, you know, mad at Seitz for filming it and stuff.
Well, of course. They're mad at anybody that
who
shows
exposes.
You, that's right. That shows you the crimes that imperialism commits. They want to give a sanitized version of this genocidal attack against Iraq to the American people. You know why? And Tracy, this is important now. It's because we're not all down with this stuff. And you know why? Because people aren't all barbarians and aren't all sucked into this vortex that you're talking about. There are people who want to resist this, who can see the difference between
right
and wrong.
Well, the mere fact that they are out there propagandizing as much as possible and attacking various elements that speak an alternative world makes that more than obvious.
That's right. Well, but y'all see, you know something? As the gentleman stated, unarmed, wounded soldiers are to be treated like a civilian. That's from the Geneva Convention. Well, then, we have to ask. Well, then why? You know, it's funny here. He says the gentleman, it's not funny at all, excuse me. It's strange that the gentleman here says, well, you know, did they get properly trained? You know, there's more to being involved in military conflict and running an army than some abstract training manual, you know? It's also guided by what you allow to happen and what you do when something goes wrong. Because understand this, there is a racist genocidal impulse involved in this activity now in the Middle East. Let's not kid ourselves. That's what we see, whether you want to see it or not. That's what it is. If you don't know what it is, I'll say it again. It's a racist genocidal impulse. And it's American as apple pie, my brothers and sisters. Remember, the only good one is a dead one. Where did that come from?
Actually, it came from Sheridan concerning the Native Americans. Now, next, let's go into another element of barbarity. Dyncorp's slave trade. Next up is Catherine Austin Fitz, who gives a background. You know, she was a former assistant secretary. She outlines the response she got when she sent her letter about Dyncorp slave trading to various governmental agencies where Dyncorp has a governmental contract. The Dyncorp slave trade thing basically got broken out initially by Ben Johnson, who was at one time an employee there, and it found out that a number of top officials in Bosnia who were a part of Dyncorp had bought them up young little girls and held them basically as slaves, and also bought a brothel and were basically using them as sex slaves. You know, it bought them through the whole market system and things of that particular nature. But as this society slips more and more into the abyss, this type of immorality just doesn't seem to stick the same way that, let's say, Ron Artest throwing a couple of blows does. Check this out.
Dyncorp, remember, Dyncorp is a way that you and I as taxpayers pay a private company to collect and manage literally trillions of gigabytes of data about all sorts of stuff. For example, they manage contracts on the war on drugs at the Department of Justice, HUD, and at the Department of State for the war on drugs in South America. And part of that is simply collecting and managing both the information systems and the data you need to make the war on drugs feasible. I sent it to the Fileri Action Network, but then I also used the web and looked up a lot of the Inspector General, Chief Information Officers, and also Chief Financial Officers at a lot of the government agencies where Dyncorp has contracts, and I sent all of them a copy of the article through the internet, and I tried to send it to as many of the Dyncorp project managers who were at those agencies as well. You know, it's a matter of courtesy. If you're going to send it to the CIO and the CFO and the Inspector General, you also make sure the Dyncorp folks get it so they're not surprised. And the reaction I got was astonishing. One of the head of the Chief Information Officers Council at the GSA wrote me a very nasty note saying, you know, how'd you get this list? You know, you're not supposed to use this list for this. A bunch of email notes saying, you know, it's inappropriate for you to send this to us. This is irrelevant. You know, this is not relevant to what we're doing. All sorts of nasty notes. And then I got one note from a guy in military contracting who just renewed my faith in America. Said, this is outrageous. I can't believe this. Thank you for sending this note. I need to know. The Inspector General at the SEC gave it to this to the CIO, and he then wrote me a very nice note, which I thought was very professional and appropriate. But other than this one military guy and the CIO at the SEC who handled it very, very well, I was amazed at how no one wanted to know. And then, to my shock and amazement, about a week or two later, both the Navy and the NASA announced huge new big contracts for DynCorp. And that's with the cover story of Insight going to every member of Congress's office. So, the feeling I was left with is best described by my cousin Jane, who's, she and her husband are cotton farmers here in Hickory Valley, and I asked her to read the article and tell me what she thought. And she said, I cannot fathom a world where not only is this happening, but our own congressmen and senators couldn't care less and do nothing.
Now, this is in part why I'm doing this segment, because, it's not just about, are all people caught up in the drone mentality and in this kind of loss in the abyss of humanity in one soul. This actually has to do in part with the fact that many people who are within this particular society basically have linked hands with various elements within the whole corporate market system. They allow to be spoon-fed and IV'd the poison that this market institution pumps out daily. And thereby, many things that should kick up their level of awareness and consciousness and concern on a basic human level often just gets lost in the abyss, because they become programized when to jump up and rage and know when and what to rage about and what not to. So many people that you come across will set forward 1,001 excuses and get into this, well, not all corporations are like this, and so on and so forth, and just try to look for any and every excuse to excuse DynCorp or the police when they get caught ass out, et cetera, et cetera. So what we have basically is a society and a culture in denial that has prolonged this type of thing for such a long time that the concept of even resisting and striking back in a consolidated iron fist way for true justice often is truly lost also in the abyss. The fact that you can have many of these officials that Captain Austin Fitz sent these letters to exposing these people at DynCorp, saying that this is irrelevant. Yet at the same time, we all know that if someone sent a list out about say Bonds had a lot of people he did commercials for, and sent lists, well, look, Barry Bonds is, it seems that he did use steroids. Many of these same people within this society and within these institutions would not consider that irrelevant. In the same way that Kobe Bryant lost a lot of contracts when he was charged with rape. Many people did not consider that information irrelevant when they dropped him from being, you know, a little sponsor for their little, you know, poison, you know, various, you know, Sprite, you know, sodas and all of that type of stuff. So the fact that we have a society where it's conditioned within it on what to get your antennas up in an outrage about and what not is something that those of us who really want to understand what we're fighting against to survive need to be more and more aware of.
Absolutely. You know, when you hear, I don't know about, you know, you guys out there, our listeners, but I suspect that you feel as sick as I do when you hear about the reemergence of human slavery. Now, only on slavery boats, you don't get to hear a whole lot of this stuff. I mean, well, this is not one of our brighter shows. I guess it's a little dismal, but there's a reason we're bringing this to your attention. We're not saying this to make you feel bad. We want you to look at this. See what's happening in Sudan. Now, Sudan is a country of black people. So that you have the reemergence of slavery. Oh, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Well, guess what? They're talking about this dying corps, primarily white, white, Caucasian, American executives. And let me tell you, we're talking about Bosnia. These are white women, in a real sense. I mean,
kids.
Yeah, children. Oh, Jesus. Stay off the... Oh, man. I'm trying to... This is difficult. It's difficult enough, Tracy. How hypocritical can they get when they find somebody that did the nasty with somebody on a boat a few years ago? I remember this presidential candidate did the nasty with some model, some Playboy model on the boat, and he's out of the race. He can't be president of the United States because he got some boo-boo. And they're going to turn around and buy children. White children. See? Why am I saying that? I'm not saying that because I think that in any way I have any get back in me, or I think it's irrelevant, or I think that it's any way, you know, permissible. Or, no. It is the hypocrisy here that you have to see. They just dropped a guy in New Jersey. He had some relationship with another man. He was a governor, and he went and did something with another man. Now he can't be governor no more. But no, you can buy children, see, and it's all good. It's irrelevant.
As long as you had the corporate flag up your ass.
And I'm telling you, this nation, we in trouble, y'all, and I know the cure. And I do know the cure. This is a decadent, dying system. But before this system and those who benefit from it are swept into the dustbin of history, they will befoul the Earth's atmosphere, both physically and psychologically, with all manner of toxins. And that's why it is so desperately necessary that you fight back, y'all. We can't just sit around and watch them take children, sell them into sexual slavery, and just, oh my, that's quite interesting. No, somebody got to die, y'all, so that somebody might live.
Now, next to show how the perpetual false image of the empire just keeps going on within all levers. Here's Neil Cohen from NPR, Talk of the Nation. This is before the war. Let's hear him talk about the corporate media's responsibility and how they must tell the truth about what's going on during the war, once the war takes place. So let's hear what Cohen has to say pre the Iraqi war. Check this out.
It's our responsibility to tell our readers and listeners and viewers what they need to know accurately and fairly and quickly. Never easy, and war presents a unique set of editorial dilemmas. How much should we trust official sources? How long do we keep journalists on the front lines when their lives might be in danger? How many sources do we rely on to confirm a story that could spread panic? Do you publish or broadcast important information if the government doesn't want you to, or if the military says it might risk the lives of American soldiers? And how important is it to scoop the competition? Today, we'll talk with executives from three news organizations who may face those questions and others in the days and weeks ahead. Andrew Rosenthal of the New York Times, Marcy McGinnis of CBS, and Bruce Drake of NPR News.
So, there you heard Neil Cohen before the war get this Pollyannish type of construct about, things that the media should take an interest, all given the illusion that this is something that they really grapple with and are concerned about, how much information and how honest and, you know, it's a duty. Yet we know, and it was clear how they were going to act before the war even started. It was clear then, in part, it should have been, because of how they were allowing the administration to lie up and down the aisles about the so-called weapons of mass destruction and just regurgitating it out. So you already had basically a platform to already dissect the corporate media on. I'm not even talking about their even past history of other things. So once the war got jumping off, it was clear that they were going to be bandwagon players for the empire because they're part of the system. But if you get caught in listening to that whole Pollyannish Orwellian doublespeak, you'll get thrown off key and once again be susceptible to slipping into the abyss.
Yes, indeed, the head-fixing industry plays its role here, brothers and sisters. We understand that role, and that's why we here at Slave Revolt are dedicated to bringing you the truth, to trying to stimulate your intellect in every possible conceivable manner, to let you know what's going on, to place before you the tasks of this epoch.
Now, next, a caller. This is once again before the war starts. A caller calls in on NPR's Talk of the Nation and talks to General Nash and says that, look, you know, you guys are claiming that there's weapons of mass destruction. If they're not found, Sam has no clothes on. So let's see how Nash responds to it pre the war, and let's see how things, as we know, have played out since. Check this out.
Our next caller is Justin, who's on the line with us from Vancouver, Washington.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Okay.
Hi, I think a lot of people would agree with me that merely by being in this conflict or being about to enter this war, that we've already failed, that it's really at best our success is just in saving face. And hopefully, if we do discover some sort of evidence that they hold weapons of mass destruction, that's the only real way we can, you know, like I said, save face on it. If we don't find that, I don't see how we can do anything more than just issue a public apology. Sorry, oops, our bad. We didn't mean to invade you. We were wrong all along. I think that being in this conflict to begin with really shows that we failed.
So even any minimal degree of lack of embarrassment from your point of view, Justin, would require the discovery of chemical, biological weapons?
Yes, definitely.
General Nash?
Well, I would comment that I think the demonstration that our concerns and intelligence is in fact going to be a measure, if not of success or failure, but a measure of our wisdom within the international community. And I think there is a potential that there be a backlash should it be demonstrated that we were wrong about our assessment. We'll never be able to be cavalier about it in terms of saying oops or something like that. I mean, this is a very significant matter at hand.
Now, what's interesting about this is that, while before the war, like Nash was saying, General Nash, that, you know, if they don't find weapons of mass destruction, we can't be cavalier about it. We can't just say oops and stuff like that. This will be a very serious matter at hand. But how did it work out? Once they didn't find the weapons of mass destruction, they shapeshifted it over to getting rid of Saddam, to bringing democracy into Iraq. In other words, right before our eyes, without the same corporate media system that you just heard this general on saying how they'll be held accountable if they don't find weapons of mass destruction, you haven't heard them hold them, the Pentagon, accountable for not finding weapons of mass destruction. They shape-shifted right along with the Pentagon. They helped mold people right in their humanity right into the abyss. So all of the stuff that you have just heard concerning what is happening in Fallujah right now, the whole ID system and work brigades, you know, this Nazi type stuff and massacring of people, the whole Abu Ghraib stuff that is taking place, this in part takes place because the soullessness of the corporate media system is also attached like an umbilical cord to the soullessness of the state. They're part of the system that basically helps crush your humanity into the ground, into the earth. They are part of the problem. Now, as we finish this up right quick, to show you how cronyism plays a whole role in the corrosion process, and how those who believe in the market system, you know, and just want to be part of, you know, some little petty bourgeois, so on and so forth, or, you know, just the bourgeois themselves. Bob Kurak, who at one time is now, he's being appointed as the security chief by Boy George. At one time, he was a member of Giuliani's partners, former Saudi security chief. He was a New York cop commissioner, so on and so forth. Here's Fred Capula from Slate.com and others talking about basically who this Kurak clown is. And you can get a picture of how people who operate within this mechanism, from Jesse Jackson on down the long jury line, lose their soul within the abyss of the empire. Check this out.
He was appointed in May of 2003 to go over to Iraq, not merely to head up their police force, but to become the interim interior minister in charge of border security, as well as police, everything an interior minister would do. He said when he went over there, I think he told Newsday, that he would stay at least 6 months, as long as it would take. And he announced that he was coming back home in mid-August. That's 3 months. In the meantime, he spent $1.2 billion of government money to train several thousand new Iraqi police into Jordan, and bought a lot of small arms from Jordan, small arms the sorts of which he could have picked up off the street in Iraq, or could have gotten for free from the disbanded Iraqi army. He left with no fanfare. The job obviously wasn't done. The job is still not done with the Iraqi police force. And so a good question is, why did he come back so soon? From what I've heard, he was pretty much a zero at this job. Now, some people could say, well, it's a hard thing. I mean, I don't know who could have run the Iraqi security force, and that's probably right. But this is an example of a huge managerial responsibility involving something with which he'd had no prior experience. I think it's worth asking what happened over there, a kind of a day-by-day, week-by-week of Bernard Kerik as Iraqi security minister, I mean, interior minister.
In Bernard Kerik's rise, you have to understand his relationship with Rudy Giuliani. If it weren't for Rudy, none of us ever would have heard of Bernie. When the two guys met, Kerik was a driver and bodyguard to Giuliani in his mayoral campaign. And literally every good thing that has happened to Kerik since has been a direct result of that relationship. Becoming the corrections commissioner, becoming the police commissioner. This is a guy who had not achieved many notable successes in any of those fields until he met Rudy, and now Giuliani endorsement and support of the Bush administration, I think has played a big role in delivering him to this latest position.
Let's assume that both gentlemen, Kerik and Giuliani, are as honest as the day is long, as they say in Casablanca. This still raises questions. Giuliani just took over a financial investment branch of Ernst & Young. Let's say that they might be investing in some companies that do business with Homeland Security. Giuliani has his chief acolyte, as Ellis said, his former bodyguard and driver, the man who was made by Giuliani, now sitting at the helm of Homeland Security, knowing when the alerts are going up, knowing when the contracts are going up, maybe determining who gets these contracts. There are some real conflict of interest questions to be raised.
It's good to have friends, isn't it?
Yes, very good.
This helps expose that, this is really not about talent. This is about obedience. Obedience to the system. This is cronyism. See, these clowns are nothing to be looked up to or emulated, but it does help expose that if you think you can work from the inside and somehow change things, then basically, once again, your soul will be lost into the abyss. It's clear why he bought all these guns in Jordan instead of just getting them in Iraq, you know, where they are all over the streets and stuff, and you could just pick them up, you know, like you were able to sweep up cod out of the ocean at one time before the corporate farmers, fish farmers, destroyed them. Basically, they were just basically doing a service to the Jordan government, you know, just buying them off by, you know, throwing cash their way and buying arms that they really didn't need to buy from them. This is a part of cronyism, you know. So those who are within the system intentionally play into this type of stuff and then give the image of someone being sound and solid, when in actuality they're just part of the corporate globalized problem. Hold on a sec. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for Slade tonight. It's clear that as long as you believe in the system or try to operate within it as a vehicle for change, you and your soul will be lost in the abyss. For those who are on truly a mission of slave revolt, we know that what that really means in essence is a time for living. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.